Picture this. Fireworks, strobes, the opening chorus of Superbass, blowing out the sound system like we're about to witness a headlining set at Coachella. The crowd roars. And then Nicki Minaj totters out, dressed in red and business casual, weaved down to her knees, but otherwise buttoned up and proper. She sits down in a white armchair, knees crossed, microphone in hand, like she's about to moderate a corporate panel on workplace culture in the age of AI. The music cuts and you notice the Fox Live graphic and a demonic entity, Erica Kirk, grinning at her. They launch into a real meeting of the minds here, reading out tweets about Gavin Newsom. She delivers a dead serious, reverential testimonial for the president, saying he has her utmost respect and admiration. She then attempts to deliver a bar about boys being boys, which is a thinly veiled, loserific potshot at trans people, met by thunderous applause. Are we in the Twilight Zone? Is that our Nicki Minaj, the fluent, funny wordsmith, once the undeniable queen of rap, sitting across from King Julian? It's like watching an ABBA Voyage hologram concert, a manipulated digital version of someone that used to be great. When she's asked how she feels about the tremendous backlash she's receiving for being there and standing 10 toes down with the people who want to destroy most of her once beloved fan base, her response?
I didn't notice. Stay mad.
Part of the reason why this shift feels so discombobulating is because it's a betrayal of the very people who gave her the cultural power to shock in the first place. She's been living off the goodwill of the girls and gays for over a decade, an audience that is overwhelmingly, though not universally, liberal and, in 2026, frequently under attack. If you've paid even slight attention to Nicki Minaj over the last 5 years, you know this didn't come out of nowhere. Nicki has been on a long, increasingly absurd downward spiral, really, ever since she married a registered sex offender. Her music has grown boring and stale. The bars are defanged, her instincts clearly dulled. The creative energy that once went into her craft and her character has been rerouted into impulsive feuds and endless shadowboxing with enemies both real and imagined. What's missing is the thing that used to make her magnetic: cleverness, creativity, cool. Nowhere was that clearer than her recent attempt to swing back at Megan Thee Stallion. On paper, this should have been Nicki's moment, the kind of diss record that she has built her reputation on, the clutch jumper she used to sink without even thinking. Instead, she missed, badly. Bigfoot is an embarrassing snapshot of how far her instincts have eroded. Sloppy rollout, outdated punchlines, long stretches where she barely even raps, just mutters grievances over a generic beat like she's scrolling her Twitter timeline and ranting into her phone. Meg, meanwhile, treated their Cold War like a technician. She uses the diss track form to clarify a narrative, test her pen, and turn public doubt about her personal life into creative fuel, something more than just getting a shot at Nicki Minaj. She rapped, and in her response, Nicki collapsed. Megan's diss went number one, and Nicki's response limped onto the charts, slid off of streaming, and evaporated so completely that Megan didn't even bother to reply. The woman who used to be the most feared feature on a track can't even land a hit in a fight that she picked. So, what happened? How do you go from inventing a whole archetype, the hyper-feminine rap supervillain who bent the culture around her, to playing defense for people who fundamentally do not understand irony, camp, or play? My armchair diagnosis is that Nicki Minaj never did her shadow work. Her ugliest instincts have always been on display: paranoia, vindictiveness, the need to dominate. For most of her career, those instincts were rewarded and celebrated, but she never integrated the darker parts of those so that they could become something positive. Instead, the badness metastasized. Enter beef. In hip-hop, beef is one of the fastest routes to iconography because it offers something the real world rarely does: clarity, a winner, a loser, a knockout. Nicki grew addicted to the feeling of resolution that beefing provides. It was never enough for her opponents to be less talented. She needed to stand over them while they failed. Victory was not sufficient, and domination is always the point. That's what I'm calling the genius trap, when being the greatest of all time is your whole identity rather than a creative challenge to keep getting better. Once you've decided that you are not just one of the greats, but the greatest female MC alive, every peer becomes an existential threat. Respect is rationed rather than extended generously, and other women walking in your footsteps starts to seem like theft to you when really, it is your inheritance. I am not a hip-hop scholar. I'm a pop critic, a white Irish gay man who grew up in Singapore, which means that there will be blind spots here, and when I hit them, I will try to tell you. I'll defer to voices with more cultural authority than mine, and yes, we are going to have to give Nicki her flowers today, because if there wasn't an extraordinary legacy here, there would be nothing worth autopsying. Two things can be true. If you're new here, hi, my name is Zach. I'm the Swiftologist. I make thoughtful weekly videos about pop stars, power, and the stories we tell about genius, fame, and collapse. This is part of a series I call How to Murder Your Career. At its core, it's about self-sabotage, the choices that artists make once they've already won, that slowly hollow out the thing that made people care in the first place. I've covered Ed Sheeran, Selena Gomez, Demi Lovato, Katy Perry, and Nicki Minaj is joining that hallowed canon today. Make sure to subscribe to my channel if you like this video, because I busted my ass putting it together for you. You don't even need to know the trials and tribulations that went into making this. So today, we're not doing a full history of Nicki's career or a comprehensive beef recap. That work exists elsewhere, and it's done with a lot better context than I can offer alone. I want to zoom in on how one of the most influential artists of her generation ended up karate chopping ghosts instead of making great work, and what that says about the culture that made her and where it is now. Nicki Minaj's importance in hip-hop can't be overstated, but more importantly, it can't be reduced. She wasn't just the female rapper who made it through. She was a feminizing force in a genre that has spent the better part of two decades insisting that women are either decoration, exception, or collateral damage, shunting them into a handful of archetypes that were always downstream of men's narratives. Which isn't to say that there weren't female rappers who thrived before Nicki, but the way she interacted with the genre was unique and singular. A lot of this groundwork has been articulated far more rigorously and frankly more authoritatively than I could manage alone. FD Signifier's video essay on Nicki and the women he brings into that conversation, Fab Socialism, T Noir, and Khadija, lay out with precision just how disruptive Nicki's entrance actually was. She didn't just win at the game, she forced the game to change its rules to account for her. What I've learned from binge-watching FD Signifier over the last few weeks in preparation for this is that gatekeeping is an inherent part of rap and hip-hop in a way that is different to other genres. Country music gatekeeping, for example, is, as we all know, mostly racist. Gatekeeping in hip-hop serves a different purpose, to protect the art and ensure its proliferation. Authenticity is a core tenet of hip-hop, especially to the purists. You can't just rap well, you have to say something when you rap. And where you come from matters too. What rap lineage are you a descendant of? East Coast, West Coast, Atlanta? Where did you learn? Can you freestyle? These questions are stress tests for artists that ask them if they are being real, and they extend to how your body, voice, and persona code within hip-hop's idea of real blackness. Realness or authenticity is an essential part of participating in the genre and garnering respect from the gatekeepers. I will list a bibliography of all the sources that I used to write this video in the video description so that you can check it out after you're done. The realness test has always been gendered. For men, authenticity is mostly about proximity to danger, the credibility of your origin story, your ability to narrate violence without sounding like you borrowed it from a movie, or your fluency in the unspoken codes of the culture. For women, it's a double bind. You're expected to be from the culture, but you can't be too from it. You can be desirable, but not available. Hard, but don't try to be one of the guys. Feminine, but don't be frivolous. The second a woman leans into performance, sexuality, the kind of hallmarks of pop music, the things the genre already sells through male artists, she's treated like she's diluting the art form instead of expanding it. If she's soft, it's fake, too sharp, and she's a bitch. Being real in practice has often meant be small enough to be tolerated. Nicki actually laments this in one of her first viral moments, a clip of her getting ready for a show in an early documentary with her pink wig on.
When I am assertive, I'm a bitch. When a man is assertive, he's a boss.
Bossed up.
He bossed up.
Yeah, he bossed up.
No negative connotation behind bossed up, but lots of negative connotation behind being a bitch.
FD Signifier and the women in his video articulate this super clearly. Prior to Nicki, the women who broke through were frequently positioned as adjacent to male power, the first lady of a label, the protege of a crew, exception granted access by the gatekeepers. And even when they were stars, they were kind of forced to pick a lane that felt legible to men. Either you perform masculinity convincingly enough to be respected, a la Missy Elliott, or you perform sexiness in a way that makes you useful, a la Lil' Kim. The range of acceptable womanhood in rap was narrow, and it was policed by everyone. Men who didn't want their genre invaded by femininity, and women who'd already survived the hazing and didn't want the standards lowered to make it easier for the next girl. Nicki's clever hack is that she refused the premise of the question. She didn't prove she belonged by becoming less feminine. She made hyperfemininity the weapon. She showed up exactly as she was, the theater kid from LaGuardia performing arts high school, possessed by New York battle rap with voices and characters and costumes, accents and monster flows. She was sexy, funny, mean, aggressive, scary, and sweet. This wasn't packaged for male approval necessarily, which isn't to say it wasn't for the male gaze. Nicki definitely used her hyperfemininity to dominate men and women, not just submit. Scholars have argued that what she was inventing here was a distinct black camp language, what scholar Erie McMillan calls Nikki aesthetics — this will come up a couple times in this video — that crashes hip-hop's boys club by swapping street realness for girly artifice without giving up power. In that framing, she dials up sexual spectacle while refusing sexual availability, turning Barbie drag and over-the-top performance into an armor rather than a weakness. This was a clever hat trick. She could rap explicitly and dress provocatively without offering herself to men in the way the industry expects women to. Why? Because she was real, in the only way that ultimately matters. She could really rap. Nicki Minaj is widely recognized as a great rapper when she feels like it and puts her mind to it, and from early on she knew this and refused record deals that required ghostwriters because she believed correctly that her pen, her perspective, her character was the whole point. Before her breakthrough, Nicki spent roughly 5 years cutting her teeth in various rap groups, making mixtapes, contributing verses, posting her music on MySpace, and doggedly pursuing label executives that she thought would understand her vision. Lil Wayne finally did. Nicki repositions the female rapper from object to author by becoming the main character. This is why she was so hard to place for gatekeepers. The usual authenticity checks didn't work on her. She could rap, clearly. It wasn't all aesthetics. She could outverse the men on their own tracks and not sound like a novelty while doing it. She arrived by announcing to the room that it already belonged to her, and then built an audience so loud and hungry for the kind of femininity that she was selling that the room had to accept her. Critics at the time noted how her alter egos, her wigs, her cartoonish body blurred the lines between rapper and video vixen, subject and object, but always in a way that kept her as the central attraction, not an accessory. Now, who was buying Nicki's music, hyping her up, and making her a force to be reckoned with by the gatekeepers at this time? Black women and black gay men who were hungry for the expansion of hip-hop performance in the culture that Nicki provided. Interviews with black girls from around this time describe her as both confusing and empowering, a figure whose blonde wigs, Barbie alter egos, and hyper-curvy body recycled all the contradictory media images they grew up with, but also made it possible to imagine their own bodies celebrated rather than demonized. For queer boys especially, the Super Bass Pink Friday era became a formative camp text. Here is a digital diva whose voice, face, and color-saturated videos already mirror the ways they've been using camp to survive. Nicki took the black girls and the gay boys with her to the center of the room in her ascent. And of course, because of this, the backlash was intense. Nicki's success was impossible to ignore, and it was largely fueled by women or feminine-leaning people, which triggers the cultural contempt that plagues basically every female artist or female hobby that takes up space in the music industry or the world. We have a reflexive urge to treat anything that teen girls adore as inherently fake or dangerous or stupid. This is a tale as old as time, from the Beatles to One Direction to Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber. In hip-hop, that contempt intersected with a landscape where, as veterans in Ava DuVernay's My Mike Sounds Nice point out, women had already been pushed from a crowded 90s field back to a handful of visible female MCs by the 2000s in a business that saw female rappers as expensive, risky, and ultimately expendable. Nicki's backlash was incredibly intense. She was a trailblazer, and it's difficult to be the first of your kind. In the late 2000s rap landscape, where taste was tied to status and masculinity, a woman whose primary fandom was young women got read as a threat to the genre's seriousness. Again, the question of realness arose. The hate against Nicki became a cottage industry of gossip that served one purpose: prove that Nicki Minaj is a fraud. She doesn't belong here. Rumors about who she slept with to get her record deal, speculation about her body modifications, inordinate focus on her wigs and her outfits, the same body she was using as performance art got dissected as evidence that she was really, really fake. If you can convince yourself that Nicki Minaj isn't real, then you don't have to reckon with what her success proves. Femininity is formidable. Which is the real point. Nicki broadened the scope of what being real was. She made it bigger. She proved that authenticity in rap doesn't have to look like stoicism, hardness, or male-coded cool. You can be a chaotic girl, a colorful girl, a vulgar girl. You can be freaky and do voices and perform like a Broadway star and still be a real rapper. This is enshrined most iconically in what many rap purists still agree is her best verse very early on in her career, Monster with Jay-Z and Kanye West. She ate both of those legends in their industry up, and everyone knew it instantly. The best part about this being considered her best verse is that it does all the things I just mentioned. Pink wig, thick ass, give 'em whiplash. An unapologetically dominant, hyper-feminine moment from a young, hungry artist with something to prove. It doesn't get realer than that. In the fire of defending Nicki Minaj's realness and authenticity, we meet the Barbs, a community tasked with defending their fave from relentless, often misogynistic at the time, attacks armed with in-jokes and nicknames and a shared sense of grievance and a common goal. Nicki was told repeatedly that she changed the rules. It was more than just success she was experiencing. By 2010, off mixtapes and feature verses alone, she was being profiled as the new queen of hip-hop, with 7 songs on the Hot 100 at once, and Kanye West calling her the scariest artist in the game and a potential all-time great. When Pink Friday finally dropped, critics viewed it as a neon pop rap playground that rewired what a mainstream rap debut by a woman could sound like, mixing bubblegum hooks with rap credibility in a landscape that hadn't seen a platinum female rapper in years. Being told that you've saved female rap is rocket fuel, but it's also a setup. From the jump, Nicki articulated her ambition in totalizing language. In early print and TV interviews, she talks about world domination, wanting to be known as the queen of hip-hop who opened doors in every area of entertainment for other women, and about being on conference calls with lawyers and executives because it's her brand and she commands respect. In XXL's 20th anniversary issue, she flat out defines her role as introducing female rap to pop culture and proving that a female MC can move product and land big corporate deals. These are "I am the blueprint" statements. When the New York Times is calling you the most influential female rapper of all time by album 2, it's not hard for your internal "I made it" narrative to become "I am female rap." At first, that belief really sharpened Nicki. She leaned into her Nicki aesthetics as a deliberately artificial, playful, camp performance language and worked herself into a pop rap space that no one else had occupied before. But this is where the genius trap kicks in. When the greatest of all time is your whole identity, you've built your self-worth on being the only one. Is that a powerful place to be? Sure, but it's also lonely and it can be punitive for others around you. Nicki really internalized that she was the first to introduce female rap to the mainstream and the only woman who can hang with the men and sell like a pop star. In that mentality, every new girl that benefits from these shifts that she makes can become a threat to her internal narrative that she is singular. In the music industry, the crown is earned. It's not automatically given. You can lose it at any time and you have to keep earning it. This is dangerous when it's the only thing holding your sense of self-worth together. Beef is where the genius trap finds its perfect drug. As I mentioned, beef offers something real life can't, a clear winner and loser. You get structure, a diss, a response, escalation, a knockout, and public receipts of your knockout in the form of bars and memes and charts. For Nicki, who already felt that she had something to prove as the lone woman in a male space, that competitive loop was intoxicating. Respect wasn't hard enough. She wanted to be feared, like one of the greats. Over the years, you can watch her relationship to beef slide from strategic to compulsive. Early on, subliminals at unnamed haters and industry doubters were a way to cement her place. The standard "I'm here now" move talk that every rapper does. But as that career goes on, Nicki's approach to conflict and beefing strays away from the historic and creative fuel of creating art in order to bolster a narrative or prove that you're quick or with it or can come up with an interesting bar or rhyme. Instead, she wants to put people down and reinforce the hierarchy of her at the top and everyone else below her. Not only can I out-rap you, I'm going to stand over your dead body while I send my minions, the bar, to pick apart your course. If you live in this place where "I changed the game and nobody gave me my full credit" is your backing mantra, each new perceived slight is an opportunity for you to just restage your origin story. Once again, it's you versus the world, proving that you're the greatest. Beef gives Nicki an immediate hit of that feeling whenever she wants it. Someone tweets something sideways, a younger artist gets a cover that you think you deserved, a critic questions your choices, you don't get nominated for an award. What do? You don't have to sit with the discomfort or reflect on your work or see, what role did I play in this? How could I have achieved a different outcome? You can go to the booth, drop a verse, sick the barbs on your perceived enemy, and watch the quote tweets roll in. For a while, that feedback loop can reassure you that your precious narrative is still intact. You are the queen. Everyone else is your son. But the more you rely on public domination to stabilize your self-image, the less room you leave for peers and successors and even your equals. Respect works best when it's reciprocal, but if you're constantly on guard for someone stealing your shine, it's hard to find the generosity of spirit to give back the respect that you receive. Nicki's compulsion to dominate has also probably hindered her from creating some incredible collaborations with her peers. Instead of a fluid cultural exchange, the very human and necessary process of making something with someone else becomes a process that harms you psychically because you can't give them the respect they deserve to meet them where they are. Is it really beefing when your intentions become to spiritually kill other artists by browbeating them and sending your supporters in to twist the knife? No, there's not a lot of artfulness in that process. Beef stopped being an artful tool for Nicki Minaj long ago. Now it's just a lashing out and a coping mechanism. Nicki's delusion of needing to be the only woman at the top of the pile isn't just a delusion, though. Structurally, the industry created this condition. A charts analyst for Pitchfork lays this out very clearly in extremely blunt terms as of 2017. The mainstream had only ever supported one queen of rap at a time. Across hip-hop history up until 2017, and you can map it era by Spy era, Debrat in the mid-90s, then Lauryn Hill's brief reign, a turn of the millennium window where there were a few rap queens orbiting each other, moving serious units at once. Outside of that blip, the record is very thin. In the entire history of the Hot 100 up to 2017, two female rappers had fronted a number one single exactly twice, Lauryn Hill's Doo-Wop That Thing in 98 and much later Iggy Azalea's Fancy. Pitchfork calls that early 2000s stretch a fertile period where the industry briefly treated multiple women as viable album artists. Missy is the queen with Remy Ma, Trina, Shauna, Lil' Kim, and others orbiting around her and selling at lower tiers. But the analysis points out that as soon as the post-Napster slump hits and Thug and Love rap takes over, women are pushed back to hook singer roles and the album chart fortunes nosedive. By the mid-2000s, Fergie is effectively the last queen of rap, if you ever even really considered her to be a rapper at all. And once she drifts fully into pop and Missy goes semi-retired, there's a half decade with no obvious platinum-level rapper at all. This is the void that Nicki enters in 2010. A BET documentary premieres months before Pink Friday, asking where all the women in hip-hop went. And with hindsight, Pitchfork says that Nicki's debut either defies the premise of that film or proves its argument about how narrow the conditions are for a woman to win. From that point on, the charts continue to behave as if there's only one queen of rap, Nicki Minaj. She is basically commercially uncontested until Iggy Azalea debuts in 2014, and she quickly crashes and burns. This chart analysis was published in 2017, before the new wave of female rappers really took charge and changed the game. But the article concludes that at this time, rap as a business has shown a remarkable inability to cultivate two queens at once. So when Nicki behaves like there is only room for her, she's not pulling that scarcity mindset out of her pink wig thick ass. She's regurgitating what the charts, labels, and history books have taught her. In this genre, at that time, there really was only one throne. By simply judging the patterns of history, I'm sure Nicki felt the clock ticking on her moment in the sun. Ironically, the first person who forced her to confront the possibility of being usurped or her mortality as a rapper isn't a new girl at all. It was the former queen of rap and Nicki's most obvious forebearer, Lil' Kim. Contrary to what the bar might say, Nicki wasn't exactly the very first of her kind, at least aesthetically. Before Nicki, there was already a hyper-feminine, raunchy, and technically formidable queen of rap, Lil' Kim. In Cheryl Keyes' map of women in hip-hop, Kim is one of the archetypal sister with attitude figures. She's decked out in designer lingerie, spitting hardcore bars, reclaiming that bitch energy, proving that you could be tiny and hypersexual while still being the scariest rapper on a track. It wasn't always beef between these two. It could have gone either way. Early on, around 2009, Nicki is on camera naming Foxy, Kim, and Remy Ma, who she would also go on to beef with later on, as women in hip-hop that she studied and admired. Nicki's Kim influence is widely noted straight off the bat. Remember, she was entering into a void that had basically been left by Kim, whose legal troubles and stint in jail had kept her out of relevancy for a long stretch of the early 2000s. By 2010, Kim's out of jail and Nicki is doing shady comments without directly naming her on several tracks. On Roman's Revenge, she refers to Kim as a has-been, and on a Diddy remix, she wonders if she killed a queen. Later that year, Nicki does the I'm hurt but reasonable act and tells her story where she met Kim backstage, paid her compliments respectfully.
And if that's not good enough with you, mama, then it's something deep-rooted in you. You need to get your... Something is bothering you inside. That's your insecurity bothering you. It's not Nicki Minaj. It would have been any girl that started popping.
This is very ironic in hindsight, given that Nicki extended this exact same attitude to Cardi, Meg, Ice Spice, and literally anyone else who came up after her. The telling part of this interview is the challenge that she poses to Kim. Put your music out when I see your name on Billboard, that's when I'll respond. This is the scarcity mindset in action. I'm the one moving units, not you. I've replaced you. I've killed you. I'm the queen. Climb back up to my level and maybe I'll respond, but I know that you can't. Kim responds with Black Friday, a diss track structured around a very specific accusation. You, Nicki Minaj, are a Lil' Kim clone clown who stole my entire swag and now you're acting like you invented it. She splices Nicki's interviews into the track and talks at length about Nicki in subsequent interviews. Nicki shoots back with Stupid Ho, genuinely an iconic number, we have to admit, where she again parrots the only one myth. Stupid Ho should have befriended me, then she could have probably come back. She's explicitly casting herself as the gatekeeper now, implying that if Kim had shown her some respect as the new queen of rap, then maybe she wouldn't be swinging and missing now. This is a pretty classic rap beef. Kim's line of attack is basically, Nicki, you're not real. You don't really come from these streets. People don't respect you. I've been here before you, and I could do some serious damage to you if you're not careful. This is a parallel line of attack to what eventually sunk Drake with Kendrick Lamar. You're not really of this culture that you're participating in. You don't get it like the real artists do. Kim wasn't really commercially formidable enough culturally at this point, especially in comparison to Nicki's rising global domination, but that line of attack does bear some weight when you're comparing these to artists in assessing their credibility or their right to the throne. Who came first? Who did it better? It's subjective, of course, but Nicki was never going to concede that Kim had any right to say that Nicki walked in her footsteps, even though she definitely did, and said as much herself to begin with. Nicki sidesteps the question entirely and instead antagonizes Kim on another inarguable point. It doesn't matter who came first because I'm here now and I'm slaying you. Again, very ironic when later on, the entire de-evolution of Nicki's character and the major shadow she refuses to integrate is her inability to accept that there are other talented individuals in the world who also deserve a chance to shine. There's definitely a version of this story where getting called a copycat is just an irritating news cycle you shut down and write out. Let's revisit Lady Gaga versus Madonna. The press spent a lot of time trying to force that copycat narrative when Gaga was popping off. This was aided and abetted by Madonna, who called her reductive and cheekily included a mashup of Born This Way with her song Express Yourself that Gaga was accused of copying on her tour. Gaga's response has mostly been, I'm gonna keep it cute. She's acknowledged how influenced she was by Madonna while still saying, I'm doing my own thing though. And this is the best way to do it, I think. Name your mother, shout out your references, but still insist on your own originality and hold your ground. That, I think, is the mature way to handle being part of a lineage. Nicki does the opposite. All the serious writing about Nicki points to a similar pattern. She's a genius at never standing still long enough for anyone to pin a single inheritance on her. And to be fair, she is not a copy case version of Lil' Kim. Nicki's got alter egos, the Barbie body, switching accents, the pop rap fusion thing going on. She plays with authenticity and real blackness while keeping just enough distance from any one reference point so that she can always say, no, I don't have a lineage. As I said earlier, Macmillan calls this Nicki aesthetics, a black camp performance language that turns her into a slippery avatar, unable to be pinpointed by these easy labels. In her own words and in her branding, Nicki leans into this story. I came to save a little thing called female rap. I introduced the concept of being a female rapper to pop culture. This goes beyond saying I'm the greatest that ever was. She's saying I am the origin. The Lil' Kim feud is much more than pettier beefs Nicki initiates later on, because Kim's line of attack is, you're my daughter and you won't admit it. And Nicki's response to that is, I don't have a mother. Every time Nicki refuses to acknowledge her lineage, even in situations where it would strengthen her argument, she's protecting the myth of being the first. The saddest part of this pretty iconic and interesting beef is that Nicki takes the worst possible lesson away from the saga. Here's what she could have seen. Lil' Kim is a cautionary tale. This is what happens when an industry chews through women and refuses to honor them. What if we join forces? There must be a better way for us to honor the greats while making space for up-and-comers. Instead, she internalizes that acknowledging your influence is suicide. In her mind, admitting that you came from somewhere is sharing the spotlight, and people will use that to discredit and erase you. So she overcorrects, and her worldview hardens into them versus me. And you can't have peers and siblings when you won't even acknowledge your own mother. The throne is, in her mind, a property that she owns and can grant or deny access to. And guess what? She's not a sharer. There is no circumstance in which Nicki will even allow someone to sit on her throne while she takes a well-earned break. She took being called a copycat so personally that she then became the gatekeeper. This is a boring and isolating job that stops you from innovating because it disallows you from being inspired by the innovations that were made in the wake of a tsunami you brought by yourself. All right, now let's get into some tea. Nicki has 89 million beefs, and most of them are, unsurprisingly, with other female rappers. There are plenty of exhaustive videos on the many beefs that Nicki has, but today I want to zoom in on her issues with Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, because these are the ones that distress her the most, and her weak flop responses to both of them over the years make her growing irrelevance impossible to ignore. Both of these feuds vary in intensity over the years, but recently hit a fever pitch before her MAGA turn, and they expose how Nicki's old survival strategy failed once the landscape around her changed to be more accommodating of female rap, which she once proclaimed was her mission to achieve as an artist. As we've discussed, up until 2017, Nicki has been operating from a scarcity mindset. She stepped into a vacuum in the industry, created a new model for up-and-coming artists to follow with her business and her image strategy of outlandish caricature, technical excellence, fandom cultivation, and social media marketing. By the late 2010s, the system takes that formula and allows other people to use it. We've got Cardi B, Megan Thee Stallion, City Girls, Saweetie, Lotto, and Doja Cat getting the coveted resources that Nicki once thought were only available to one queen at a time. Major label pushes, Grammy nominations, Hot 100 hits, massive fan bases. What was once a boys' club with one exceptional girl is now a crowded field where multiple women can inhabit a multitude of archetypes enjoying commercial dominance simultaneously. There are quite literally more seats at the table. This should be a good thing, right? Nicki talked a big game at the outset of her success about trailblazing and making space. But when the space appears and other women use her blueprint to build their own empires, Nicki doesn't respond like a proud architect. Oh no, no, she turns into a curmudgeonly landlord. This is the first time in Nicki's career that the conditions she once thrived respect under no longer exist. Scarcity, being the great, being the only one, the queen, the first, made her feel exceptional. Abundance makes her feel ordinary, and she does not have the psychological tools to exist in an abundant version of female rap. Chronologically, the first real crack in Nicki's The Greatest and the Only myth arrives with someone who shouldn't have challenged her at all, really, just from a technical perspective, Cardi B. Cardi represents a new era of hip-hop star, the personality-driven diva. This is something Nicki has leaned into over the years, but she's always emphasized that her talent and her penmanship is what sets her apart. It was probably maddening for her to watch a self-proclaimed student of hers create a new cheat code that would ascend her to the throne. In early interviews, Cardi states multiple times how she grew up on Nicki's music, calls her one of the great rappers, and shuts down ideas of them beefing. For a while, Nicki plays nice. When Bodak Yellow starts climbing the charts, Nicki publicly congratulates Cardi as it finally goes number one. Cardi thanks her and says it means a lot to her. This is textbook giving your flowers behavior. Had this been Nicki talking to Kim in 2010 with her own number one, you can imagine she wouldn't have played it so nice. She would have danced on that grave. The thorn about Bodak Yellow is that it's a historic win, one that Nicki probably felt was rightfully hers. Cardi is the first solo female rapper since Lauryn Hill in 1998 to top the Hot 100 without a credited feature as a solo artist. And she does this in 2017 when Nicki is arguably still in her imperial era. Nicki has dozens of Hot 100 entries, but no solo number one as a lead or even as a feature. In scoreboard culture, where Nicki has often made her case that she is the greatest, remember how she taunted Kim by daring her to appear on the charts to challenge her, relying on her commercial impact to underscore her dominance. Overnight, Nicki's statistical dominance, most Hot 100 entries, multiple platinum albums, arena tours, no longer automatically translate into the undisputed queen in the public imagination. After all this time, she still doesn't have a number one, and this newcomer, her protege, got it before she did. Unfortunately for Nicki, the hits would just keep coming for Cardi. She continues to kill it on the charts, and her debut record, Invasion of Privacy, is a coronation. The album pulls strong first week numbers, spins off multiple hits, and wins the Grammy for Best Rap Album in 2019, making Cardi the first solo female performer ever to take that category. Nicki, meanwhile, is completely shut out of nominations for her record Queen as her longstanding Grammy blacklisting and beef continues. The Queen rollout was a mess because the insecurity was apparent from the jump. Cardi really rattled her. Instead of a tight, confident era, there were countless delays, an ever-changing release date, a canceled co-headlining tour Future because of allegedly low ticket sales, management personnel changes, and a flood of personal controversies that we will definitely revisit later when we talk about her politics. And all of this drowned out the music, which, by the way, was actually, you know, pretty good. Chun-Li rocks. When Queen debuted at number two behind Travis Scott's Astroworld, this was the last straw. Nicki went sicko mode, accusing him of cheating with merch and tour bundles, honestly a fair critique, but then she called him all sorts of names and even roped in Kylie Jenner and her baby Stormy into this mess. She lashes out at Spotify for punishing her by premiering the album on Apple Music. She hints at some sort of covert suppression campaign by her own label and compares herself to Freedom, to Harriet Tubman, on the infamous Queen Radio, which became more iconic than the album itself for all the wrong reasons. Queen Radio was Nicki's personal grievance hour where she aired her many complaints and generally looked like a bitter hater. Long segments obsessing over sales bundles, detailed scorekeeping of other artists' chart accomplishments, endless ranting and raving about Cardi and Travis and other industry plants. This level of lashing out really clashed with the once cool, slippery avatar of Nicki aesthetics that made her seem untouchable. Cardi undid Nicki. Up until now, she had been able to spin beefs into part of her unfolding prophecy. I am number one forever. You will be destroyed. The direct comparison of Invasion of Privacy and Queen's release makes Cardi look fun, chaotic, and cool, while Nicki looks like a bitter veteran, grinding her teeth as the industry moves on without her. That tonal shift here is really essential to Nicki's continual undoing. Early Nicki beef used to look clever, or at least if it wasn't clever, it was silly and campy and fun. Queen Radio made her look aggrieved, and grievance is the least competitive tool in the pop culture wars. It replaces fun, mischief, and camp with bitterness. Which brings us to Megan Thee Stallion. By the time Meg shows up, Nicki has barely survived one daughter eclipsing her on the scoreboard. Megan's success is much harder to dismiss because she's closer to Nicki's own ideal of what a real rapper looks like. At least Nicki could say she could out-rap Cardi with ease. Megan proved not so easy to dominate in that area. Megan is a textbook Nicki disciple. Technically sharp, sexually explicit, terminally online, building a fan community of the hotties that sort of mirrors the Barb culture. In early interviews, just like Cardi, Meg frequently cites Nicki as an inspiration. They link up together, actually, on Hot Girl Summer in 2019, and the optics are perfect. A viral catchphrase gets turned into a single. The reigning queen swoops in to stamp it with her approval. Nicki plays the mentor role here, publicly, but goes further than the casual niceties she offered to Cardi. She praises Meg for finishing college and holds her up as proof that you can be smart and a rapper at the same time. For a minute, it seems like this is the time that Nicki will anoint an heir. The door she kicked open is now helping a younger woman walk through, and there's no visible hostility. Hooray! But again, numbers are a sore point for Nicki, who still doesn't have that number one. Megan scores 2 in quick succession, with Savage featuring Beyonce, and then WAP with Nicki's OP, Cardi B, locking Meg and Cardi in as the central architects of the late 2010s and early 2020s female rap boom. What Cardi and Meg model together on WAP is the opposite of Nicki's scarcity mantra. Their collaboration depends on there being two queens involved. The entire spectacle of WAP, the video, the discourse, the streaming dominance, is built on the idea that there's room for multiple hypersexual, commercially dominant women in the same frame at once. WAP proves Nicki's identity wrong. There doesn't have to only be one. Two women can share the throne. The reward here for the mutual respect and sharing of the spotlight by Cardi and Meg was more power for both of them. In this brave new world, Nicki's instinct to hoard the throne and shut people out seems outdated and, to be honest, pathetic. In January 2024, Meg Thee Stallion finally pens her own version of events after a few years of trying times with Hiss. It's her first big solo release since the Tory Lanez trial, which brought out all the misogynists to publicly debate if she was lying, exaggerating, or milking her shooting. It's a tightly crafted song that doles out admonishments to exes, fake friends, and industry peers who cashed in on her pain. The line that made this track a cultural moment and now a beef canon event is very simple. These hoes don't be mad at Megan. These hoes mad at Megan's Law. Just sounds like wordplay on her name, right? Well, it's layered. Megan's Law is the 1996 U.S. statute that requires public sex offender registries. She folds this reference into a punchline about envy and resentment, pointing directly at a very unpleasant truth everyone has been dancing around because they're too scared of Nicki Minaj and the Barbs. Miss Petty is married to a sex offender. Within hours, the discourse machine is in full swing and a searing indictment of Nicki's character finally emerges. Her ride-or-die narrative is not romantic. It's pathetic. Not only has she chosen to be with this man, but she has attempted to normalize him with her platform. Meg has finally done what Nicki's critics have been dancing around for years. Connected Nicki's personal life, her alignment with male abusers, and her persecution complex in one bar that is legally accurate and morally pointed. As I mentioned at the top of this video, Bigfoot flops and Hiss debuts at number one on the Hot 100, marking Meg's third number one and her first as a solo lead. It also opens at number one on the Global 200, making her the first female rapper to debut atop that chart as a lead artist. In a genre where Nicki has spent a decade using stats as proof that God and the culture are on her side, these numbers are a damning rebuke of the queen of rap in her very own language. The audience thinks you're whack and irrelevant, Nicki. Bigfoot isn't just a commercial flop, it's a humiliatingly poor response to the cutting assessment of Nicki's character that only took Meg one line to deliver. Bigfoot is a confusing track full of unrelated personal attacks, mocking Meg's height and feet, suggesting that she lied about being shot, slut-shaming her, invoking her dead mother. Critics like The Roots' Candace McDuffie argued that Nicki's line of attack here is textbook misogynoir, a black woman using another black woman's experience of violence to draw on racist tropes that liken tall, dark-skinned women to monstrous creatures as a punchline to deflect from her own moral failings. Complex's Peter A. Berry said Bigfoot was lazily constructed and points out that Nicki fails at the one thing she used to be most known for, delivering a killer verse. The beat is boring and generic, the narrative doesn't proceed in an escalatory way, and there's no new idea about Meg's character, work, or stature in the industry that is worth picking apart. By all metrics, Bigfoot fails as a diss track because it has no damning or clever critique. Up until now, we've mostly been talking about Nicki in competition terms, charts, beefs, who outrapped who. There's a more difficult to quantify loss that happens underneath all of this, but is, I believe, the true tragedy of what we're seeing now. The campy, theatrical, hilarious Nicki Minaj is blonde and gone. Now she takes herself very, very seriously. As an avatar maker, Nicki created new characters to avoid being boxed in by any one idea of real black womanhood. This helped her avoid many of the traps that are set for female rappers. Nicki never had to be one thing. And you, the viewer, were not supposed to believe that this was Onika Mirage being herself all the time. This is Nicki Minaj, a construction, a fantasy, a campy maximalist cartoon that evolves over time. This is why I think she had a large fan base of devoted girls and gays. Nicki aesthetics are a permission slip to do too much. The whole point of her as a character is that she's not literal. Present-day Nicki has entered her grievance era, and grievance insists on literalism. It's boring. There's no play or pretend when everything is dead serious to you. You can really see this shift clearly when you examine how she behaves with the men in her personal life. In 2017, Nicki's brother was convicted of predatory sexual assault against an 11-year-old girl. She's never publicly reckons with the victim or with what it means that someone that close to her did something horrific. 2 years later, she marries Kenneth Zhu Petty, a man on the sex offender registry, for a 1994 attempted rape conviction involving a 16-year-old, and he later pleads guilty to manslaughter. Instead of, again, quietly keeping that separate from her brand, she forces it on the public, folding him into IG lives, behind-the-scenes clips, pet names, and lyrics. When his victim comes forward and alleges that people connected to Nicki and Petty tried to intimidate or pay her to recant her experience, Nicki's posture is never, "I think we should leave this woman alone." She questions her story and frames the entire situation as an attack on her marriage, not the natural consequence of a man abusing a woman. This is not a logical position, so enter her grievance romance era. To keep her preferred version of her love story intact, loyal wife, misunderstood husband under siege, she has to flip the script so that the man with the record is the victim and the woman he hurt is part of a big plot against them. Her self-image depends on that reversal. When you decide that your relationship only survives if everyone else is lying or conspiring, you build a persecution narrative into the foundation of your very core. From that point on, every criticism of him becomes by definition an unjust attack on her. Doubling down on more abusive men in your life is proof positive that you are right and everyone else is wrong. In 2010, she proudly jumps on Trolls with 6ix9ine, fully aware of his own history with a minor and his broader notoriety, because the only thing that matters to her is the chart position that she can get from him, and she gets her number one. And the feeling of being proved right. She makes it very clear, if a man is useful to her emotionally or commercially, what he's done to other women is never a deal breaker. And if anyone tries to point out the hypocrisy of this by naming what he's done or asking why the hell she's standing by him, well, she's already got a paranoid narrative cooked up to slot you into. Everyone's out to get me, my family, and my crown. Jumping into being a hard right nut who believes in satanic cabals that eat children, she'd said this is what happened after the 2026 Grammys, is really not that far away from believing everyone's out to get you. Nikki betrayed her audience and the culture that elevated her long before she came out as a Trump supporter. It was really over when she married that man. Pop is broadly a liberal space. You don't have to be a perfect leftist to thrive, we know that. But you do have to be at least vaguely aligned with some common sense liberal rules of thumb. Don't spread medical conspiracy theories. Nikki was massively anti-vax, so much so that she didn't attend the Met Gala in 2021, and maybe don't marry sex offenders while still demanding the benefits of feminism. Grievance-era Nikki is very attracted to this newer hardline conservatism because it performs what she's been practicing for the better part of a decade. You are always the persecuted truth teller, and anyone who disagrees with you is trying to censor and silence you, and you have some sort of grand moral clarity that none of the mind-controlled sheep have. Meanwhile, Nikki's grand moral clarity is that Trevor Noah is secretly gay and COVID is fake because my cousin's balls swelled up after he maybe got the vaccine in Trinidad. She spent years peddling conspiracies that she's blackballed by the industry, particularly when her album doesn't go number one or when she doesn't win a Grammy, and now she's found a political ecosystem that doesn't care about due diligence or fact-checking, but instead says, oh my god, exactly, to all of your derangements, and hands you a microphone to repeat them. Conservative media is absolutely desperate for high-profile black entertainers who validate their victimhood, cancel culture, and evil liberal elite narratives. To them, her vast and diabolical fanbase who do her bidding are useful agents to spread their propaganda. She's now going to be a case study of how the evil liberal elite and their terrible cancel culture tried to ruin one of the greats and run her out of her own industry. The genius trap is what led Nicki Minaj to this position. At her very core, she cannot accept that she's anything less than a perfect, legendary icon. Every critique otherwise is an attack. You know who else views their career and life in similar terms generally? Kanye West. He is also obsessed with being the most important artist alive and loves to use his stats, Grammys, streaming numbers, chart success as proof of that dominance. When his work started to get kind of bad and his antics took center stage for all the wrong reasons, he, like Nicki, didn't take a moment to reflect and ask himself, what could I do differently here? Instead, he reframed every lost endorsement, ban, and backlash as evidence of a coordinated attempt to erase a god. Now, to be fair, we do know that Kanye is mentally ill, so that does add a layer of complexity to this, but the genius trap is on full display in Kanye's lucid moments too. Even his recent big apology he made couldn't help but remind everyone of just how big an influence he had on the culture, bringing up streaming numbers, etc., as if any of that matters more than the fact that the only person responsible for ruining his legacy is himself, his mouth, and his actions. Nikki's doing the exact same thing with a pink wig and a thick ass. She introduced female rap to the culture. She opened every door that these ungrateful bitches have walked through. The system is punishing her for being too successful and too real. And if fans don't like the music or her album gets a negative review or, God forbid, a protege lands a punch on her, her internal story doesn't budge. She is wronged and you are her enemy. The world is only bearable to Nikki when she's the greatest and the most persecuted person within it. That's why right-wing politics are so persuasive to her. A question I've mulled over and over, though, is why is Nicki Minaj doing this? Where does she think this behavior will get her? From a professional perspective, this turn is catastrophic on three fronts. First, we have the vibe problem. The people she's throwing her lot in with are constitutionally incapable of being cool. Right-wing media can platform you, it can make your voice heard, but it can't effectively make culture. They do not have the range. What they churn out incessantly is content that tries to be iconic and instantly gets memed. They really thought Charlie Kirk was going to be an anointed, saintly global figure, a podcaster, mind you. that they could browbeat everyone into retroactively respecting. Wrong. That worked for about 2 minutes. You got a couple people fired from their jobs. And then the meme started. We Are Charlie Kirk, sung by J.D. Vance. Erica Kirk trying to project menace on daytime TV and immediately getting accused of doing the Eras tour for widows. Grievance culture is inherently whack and lame. Instead of becoming iconic cultural touchpoints, conservative moments get memed into oblivion, stripping out all sincerity, making the original posters look foolish and overly serious. Because they are so obsessed with retribution and outrage, there is no space for irony or play, the raw materials of coolness. To be a successful pop star, and especially a successful rapper, you have to be cool. If you're cool, people will buy what you sell. Nicki is currently not cool and trying to sell us Boys Will Be Boys on stage with Erica Kirk. And no one is buying it. She lost so many followers on Instagram after appearing at this Turning Point USA event that she had to delete her account altogether. There is also a very ugly practical truth here that Nicki hasn't clocked or is choosing to ignore. These people don't like her. They like what she can do for them. As I mentioned, conservative media uses minorities as human shields against accusations of bigotry or as token validators for whatever culture war point they're chasing that week. The second it's easier to discard you than defend you, they will. We've seen this with other right-wing curious minority celebrities. There's a brief honeymoon period where every show wants you as the "see, we have one of them and they agree with us" guest, and then all of a sudden, the gigs start drying up. The next token appears with more relevance than you and your toast. These people are racist. Nicki Minaj, as she actually exists in the world, is a little bit vulgar, sometimes hypersexual, proudly materialistic, culturally diverse, and a literal immigrant herself. She is everything that the movement she is now aligned with claims to hate about modern American culture. They're not suddenly going to turn around and buy tickets to her concert because she thinks that vaccines were fake and she loves the Orange Man. They're making a temporary exception for her right now because she's in a useful narrow lane. She can attack liberals, other Black women, and the industries and communities she came from with some air of credibility. Let's just say they did adore her. These people are not part of the target market that would buy, stream, or support her music anyway. These aren't the divas that stood in line to buy Pink Friday or dressed up as Roman for Halloween. They're not purchasing tickets to the Nostalgia Tour because they don't know your musical catalog and they don't even consider what you do to be music in the first place, babe. They might say, hell yeah, when they see a clip of you ranting and raving on Fox News, but they do not have the interest or the power to elevate you to the status you so desperately seek, once had, and will never gain back. The audience who is capable of doing that for you, Black women, gay people, terminally online teens, you know, the people who actually drive culture, are the ones that you've alienated the most. Nicki literally has the worst of both worlds. She's training the only people who ever truly loved her work for an audience that at best sees her as a blunt instrument, and at worst finds her very existence in the world to be morally offensive. The only way Nicki could find her way back into the community would be through real contrition and accountability, saying I was wrong. Nicki's entire cosmology forbids that. If she admits that she's wrong, her worldview falls apart. She has got to be the persecuted genius at whatever cost. The harshest truth of all is that maybe Nicki had to pull a stunt like this to get some desperately needed attention because the work is no longer good enough to override the antics. Some artists can be messy or at least ambiguous politically and command a reluctant respect because their music is simply too good to deny, but Nicki isn't one of those artists anymore. Every time she has recently gotten the opportunity to have a moment, a high-profile beef, for example, she squanders it. Bigfoot is the best example of that. No one's gonna believe you when you say you're the greatest they ever made when your own students are running circles around you and attending the Grammys while you spiral on Twitter at home ranting about satanic cabals because no one wants you there. Nicki chose a lane that can't sustain the artist she once was at the exact same time that she stopped being an artist worth paying attention to in the first place. What kind of career strategy is that? I can only call it self-sabotage. This current disaster is no random fall from grace. A long string of very specific choices led Nicki Minaj to attend the Melania documentary premiere and pose gleefully with Trump like a Swiftie meeting Taylor Swift at the Secret Sessions. From pink wig to red hat, indeed. All of the sharp, funny, and theatrical elements that made Nicki Minaj a force to be reckoned with are gone. Now, she's nothing more than a paranoid, spiteful bully with a persecution complex. And that is how to murder your career. If you enjoyed this video, make sure to give it a like and leave me a comment. Let me know what you thought and subscribe for more in the future. I can't wait to see you again next week.